Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program exploring the economic aspects of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our hopes for the future, our hopes for the jobs our children may be able to get. My name is Richard Wolff. I'm the host of Economic Update. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to check out, truthout.org. If you're interested in this program and the kinds of analyses we offer, please make use of the two websites that we maintain, 24/7, available, of course, without any charge whatsoever. The first one is rdwolff.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites offer more materials, video and audio programs, entire classes in topics I think will interest you. But in addition, there are two other things both websites offer you. First, a way to communicate with us on this program, to tell us the kinds of topics you'd like us to cover, to pose questions for us to answer, and so on. It's a way for us to interact with you, and let me assure you, we read each and every one and use them to shape these programs. And the other thing you can do on either of the two websites is to click on an icon and in that way follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. And we urge you, of course, to do that. Let me begin with a piece of what I think is good news. It's not that often that we have that in looking at the economic realities we face these days around the world. But on Thursday, a week ago, roughly, the Rhode Island Senate passed a remarkable bill. And in this bill, the Rhode Island Senate said that in state contracts, that is when the state of Rhode Island buys everything from paper clips to road materials to computers, preference will be given to firms that pay their executives less than 32 times their lowest employees' pay. Now, let's be clear. The Rhode Island Senate is sending a message, and I will actually quote the state senator, Catherine Cool Rumsey by name, who made the following remark. She said, "This bill is a statement of our values. State contracts," she said, "shouldn't be rewarding firms that pay workers poorly and CEOs excessively." Wow. And to put this in context, consider that average large corporation CEOs in the United States currently earn between 250 and 350 times the lowest paid workers in their enterprises. That's research that's been confirmed by many different examinations. At the other end, consider the best known and largest worker co-op in the world, the Mondragon Corporation in Spain. They have a rule, not mandated by law, but a rule that has governed that co-op since its inception, that the highest paid worker cannot earn more than 8.5 times the lowest paid worker's income. So from the worker co-op, 8.5 times, to what the Rhode Island Senate thinks is the minimum, or rather the maximum acceptable, 32 times, to the average large corporation in this country, 300 times, you get a sense of this. But it's a remarkable step taken by the Rhode Island Senate, and I wanted to make sure folks knew about it, especially if they thought about reproducing that in their own states. The second economic update for today comes from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. In a report dated 11 June of 2014, they write a story based on a study, a scientific study, published in the British Journal of Psychiatry. And the study was conducted by the University of Oxford in England and by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And they analyzed data from 24 European countries and the United States and Canada. And what they studied was suicide, the rates of suicide, and whether there was any relationship between the number of people taking their own lives and the economic crisis that has hit Europe and North America ever since 2007. And the results are remarkable. First, suicide rates had been declining in Europe for quite some years until 2007. By 2009, 2 years deep into this recession, there was a 6.5% increase, and that level was sustained at least until 2011. What that meant was that there were, and this is the key number I want you to think about, 7,950 more suicides than would have been expected after 2007 if the previous trends had continued. In other words, recessions, particularly bad ones of the sort we have been living through these last 6 years, take a quiet toll. It's not what you read about. It's not someone flipping out and shooting other people. None of that. It's about a quiet decision by thousands of our fellow citizens that life has become too difficult and that the economic difficulties added to whatever else was already bothering these individuals proved to be something that removed them from this earth, from their family, their friends, their co-workers. Extraordinary. The same result was found in Canada. The same result was found in the United States, with this difference. Suicide rates hadn't been falling in the United States in the years before 2007. They'd actually been rising. Our economic troubles go deep and have lasted a long time. But there was an additional spurt rising above the rate of suicides before 2007, so that the United States has also experienced that, the count being that an additional 4,750 American citizens took their own lives beyond what would have been the case had the pre-2007 trends been maintained. The study also found that there were some countries that bucked the trend, some countries where, despite the economic downturn, suicide rates did not go up. Three in particular were Austria, Sweden, and Finland. And what the researchers found that was stunning is that in those countries, there were major policy efforts made by the government to help unemployed people by giving them special training to get back to work, developing systematic advice centers to help them get back to work, and the one I found most interesting, subsidizing wages, providing them with the financial help to get through an economic crisis that was no fault of their own so that they could survive better. And of course, as we now know, do less in the way of taking their own lives. Well, the Rhode Island example of trying to do something in the nature of limiting the high pay of executives, so it's only 32 times the lowest worker rather than the typical in large corporations in America, the typical 350. That takes us to yet another update, and this has to do with struggles in the United States Congress over the Dodd-Frank Act. You know, that financial reform passed during this terrible recession a few years ago. One of the things that act called for was it required corporations, larger ones, to post publicly what the ratio is between what they pay their highest and what they pay their lowest employees. It was felt that this is a basic commitment to transparency, to letting the people of the United States know what the situation is so that they can take whatever steps they believe to be appropriate. Well, this has been delayed. Surprise, surprise. This requirement of the law has been postponed. And the leading cause of that are lobbying efforts by large corporations and by their mouthpieces, such as the United States Chambers of Commerce. And I thought you'd be interested in the arguments that they make. And I didn't make this up, folks. The chamber says it would be very difficult, very costly, and very complicated to tabulate the information, to do all the research, to suggest and to figure out what the highest paid person in their company and what the lowest paid person gets. Several staff members of the Securities and Exchange Commission, among others, have countered by suggesting that they wouldn't have to check every single worker's pay. They could just take a reasonable sample among those who they know are toward the bottom and that one at the top whose salary they know. But between you and me and the lamppost, suggesting that we have to postpone this provision, which they all opposed because of the difficulty of measuring it, is what we would call in every other situation a stretch. Next budget item, next update is a budget item. The United States budget, it was announced by the government, has been reduced. The government is not running as much red ink as it was before. It's not spending as much more than it is taking in. And this, we were told, was good news. Well, it kind of is good news. You know who it's good news for? The creditors of the United States. Those wealthy individuals, corporations, and foreign governments who have done the bulk of the lending to the United States government. They want to make sure they get paid back and they get paid their interest. And so they like to see a government that is not building up its debts too quickly the way we were. So they're pleased. But let's take a look at the economics involved here. The government announced that revenues were rising 7% higher in this latest period than they had been a year ago. Okay, let's be clear. What does that mean? That means more money is coming out of the private economy, 7% more than it used to. That's money which, had it been left in the hands of most people, would have been spent on goods and services. Those are taxes, mostly paid by individuals, mostly, who now cannot spend that money because they gave it to the government. Well, you might say, that would be okay in terms of its impact on jobs and incomes if the money that was given to the government, the 7% more, was turned around and spent by the government so that the demand for goods and services and therefore the jobs to produce them would be maintained. But that's not what's happening. The government is taking 7% more of the money of the public out of their hands, but it announced with great pride that it is spending 2% less than it used to. Okay, folks, you don't need rocket science here. If the government is taking money out of the private economy at a 7% bigger clip than before, but spending, not only not spending that extra 7%, but actually spending 2% less than before, then what the government is taking is not being replaced by what the government is spending. On the contrary, the government is making the problem worse. The government is buying 2% less goods and services. It's making it impossible for people to buy as many goods and services as before by taxing them more. End result, the economy we have, the recovery that isn't working very well, that doesn't affect most people. The government, by its improving and reducing its deficit, is making the economic conditions for most Americans worse than they would otherwise be if the government wasn't so busy doing what its creditors want and instead was doing what its people need. Fourth update for this morning. This has to do with Detroit. Some of you have asked me, why do I come back to Detroit? I come back to Detroit because it is the future of the United States if we don't make massive, basic changes in our economy. It is our foretelling, if you like, to ourselves where we are going. It's a city, again, to remind you, that was the center of a thriving, efficient, world-class capitalist manufacturing center back in the 60s, even into the 70s. The place where automobiles were produced, the place where Motown music emerged to change the way the world understands and enjoys music, and so on. It had a population of almost 2 million. Today it has a population of 700,000. The majority of the people driven out of the city, which is now abandoned in large parts of it, which is seriously considering, as I have reported, destroying 40,000 dilapidated properties and perhaps much more. A city in bankruptcy. A city that suggests what can happen if you permit private corporations simply to leave to make more money, to leave behind the disaster of what happens when private enterprises build up an industry and then abandon the people that have come there to work there, often brought there by those companies, begged by those companies to come, recruited by those companies to come, even after the cities and states have given these companies enormous subsidies. They can get up, and they do, and leave, and they do, to make more profits for their shareholders, and they do, and they leave behind unemployed people, broken families, destroyed and bankrupt cities. So much I've told you in the past. New statistics I want to share with you now. And this comes from a report by the Bloomberg Financial Services on June 11th. Detroit has a greater proportion of babies that die in the first year of their life. This is called infant mortality. Than the following countries: China, Mexico, Thailand, and Saudi Arabia. That's right. Conditions in that city have deteriorated to the point where they have worse infant mortality than those countries. Wow. Pregnancy-related deaths, women whose complications lead to them dying as part of their pregnancy, put Michigan in the bottom one-fifth of all the states in the United States where that for that statistic. Nationwide in this country, according to the U.S. Census, 22% of children live in poverty. In Detroit, it is 60%. All of this reported in Bloomberg Financial News. Life expectancy is lower for adults in Detroit than in any of the other top 25 metropolitan areas of the United States. There really is nothing in the way of a comment I could make adequate to describe the human costs of permitting fundamental economic decisions like the location of production to be made not in terms of what's important for the millions of people who depend on those location decisions, but instead to be done for the tiny minority of people whose wealth depends on where location of production is made. The morality of capitalism is one of its chief failures and weaknesses. We will turn now, as we often do, to a larger topic, one that you have asked me to analyze and to present you with material to think about as you deal with this economic reality, much as you have to deal with all of the economic realities that we try to examine and to open up. I want to talk now about the economics of advertising. What do I mean by advertising? All the things that go into persuading you, the customer, the buyer, the consumer, the working person, to spend your money. It can be a billboard along the highway. It can be a television program interrupted by showing you somebody acting out that they enjoy a product. It can be the wrapping around a product that is designed to get you to buy it. It's all the different ways we are, all of us in modern society, bombarded every hour of the day through countless media with messages designed to get us to part with our money one way or another. Millions of people have jobs doing this work. These are people who would otherwise be unemployed, that's one possibility, or people who would otherwise be devoting their energy, their craft, their skills, their ideas for other purposes. I don't know, making life better for people one way or another, improving the beauty of our schools, improving the quality of our care for elderly folk, enhancing the output of ingenious new products to help. They're not doing all those other things. Instead, they're spending their time, their energy, their educational capabilities on persuading us to buy this kind of soap rather than another, that kind of soup rather than another, that car rather than another. And let's take a look at this. First, there is built into this industry a fundamental irrationality. Here's how it works. Suppose there are, just for the sake of argument, a dozen different producers of a kind of shirt. They go along producing their different shirts. You find them in the shirt stores, and you choose among them those which please you the most. End of story. But now, one company seeks to gain an advantage over the others. And it fills the highway and it fills the buses with posters showing wonderfully happy people, maybe celebrities of one kind or another, wearing their shirt. And these celebrities are scripted to say, "I am so happy with my X shirt that I would be advising all my friends and you there in the public not to buy Y brand shirt, but to join me in the happiness of X brand." All that this does is force all of the other companies to also begin to advertise. Not to gain an advantage over the first one, but simply not to gain the disadvantage that their brand seems somehow not to be in the air the way the brand is that is advertised. So we force everybody to spend huge amounts of money advertising, even if they otherwise wouldn't have, the minute one producer of anything decides to do it. So the size of advertising goes crazy, as it has around the world, the minute one competitor tries to do it. That means much more in the way of resources is spent than any rational decision of how to use resources would make us do as a people, because we have this absurd. And of course, in the end, it all nets out. You get confused, you really don't care anymore, because too many brands have spent too much time persuading you with arguments you probably didn't believe in the first place. So what you're confronting is an endless display of competitive advertising costing a fortune. And remember, the companies that have to do all this self-negating, self-canceling advertising all have one thing in common. They must raise the price of what they produce to pay for the advertising. So the shirt you buy is not costing you the money it takes to get the cloth, to have the tailor make the shirt, to make the nice design on it. It includes the cost they have, the companies that make the shirts, to advertise. Wow. That means you pay, in the end, the cost of all of those companies' silly efforts to beat one another by persuading you to buy brand X rather than brand Y. Did anyone ever ask you whether you want to pay for all that advertising? No. That's the way capitalism works. Your role as a consumer in this system is to pay even for the most irrational expenditures that this system itself imposes on producers. And last thing about advertising, which is about its economics, but also goes beyond that. If you flood the airwaves, if you flood the highway billboards, if you flood the packaging on everything that we confront in every store we enter, in any store window we look at, if you confront us endlessly with messages to buy, you're also confronting the mass of people with a peculiarly imbalanced set of influences. In other words, we're constantly told that we will be prettier, happier, more successful in our relationships, better beloved, if we buy this, if we wear that, if we have a vacation house over there, if we eat in this sort of way, these foods, that place. We're constantly told in a capitalist system obsessed with advertising, as almost all of them now are, we're constantly told a very important message that happiness, success, love, all the basic needs of a human being are available by buying something. Now, is there a comparable effort to teach us that there are other ways of building relationships, other ways of finding love that have to do with how we interact with one another, that have to do with how we think about one another, with how we approach one another as human beings working together, living together, enjoying sports together, whatever. No. There's no comparable system of messages all day long about how to understand your child better, how to be a better parent. Sure, there are some places you can go, but it has nothing to do, nothing comparable to the advertising which drowns out all the other ways to cope with life and keeps focusing us on buying objects as the way to do it. Thoughtful people have understood long ago that you can think about this with an interesting phrase, the fetishism of commodities. That is, a phrase which suggests that we as human beings give much more importance to goods that are produced in the market, to commodities, than they actually have. We don't understand in a way that we, the people, in our relationships with one another, we determine what gets produced. We tend to believe in a world of capitalist advertising that it is the commodities out there that are our way to achieve relationships. We let them shape us and kind of forget that it's we who in the end control what we produce, how we produce it, and how we distribute it. And the weak, lame defense of the advertising industry when they say, oh no, advertising is just to inform people. There'd be 1,000 ways to inform people other than trying to persuade them to buy your thing as opposed to another. If you want to be informed about shirts or soups or cars, you would want something independent, not having a vested interest in persuading you one way or another to do the investigation and to report it to you. In other words, if you really wanted information, you'd have to set up independent sources to provide that information, which is exactly what advertising isn't. Advertising is a vested interest paid by the supplier to persuade you. In the United States, we have a magazine called Consumer Reports. it's independent of all the producers, and if you actually want independent information, you can go there. It costs virtually nothing to produce this kind of evidence and to distribute it. It would save us vast waste of resources on advertising. If we did that, the government or other independent agencies could do it. It's easy. Advertising isn't about information. Advertising is about persuasion, getting you to do something you might otherwise not do. We've come to the midpoint of our program. We're going to take a very short break, and then we're going to return with more economic update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Please stay with us. We will be right back. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. And as always, after the mid-program break, I want to remind you that if these kinds of programs are interesting to you, a great deal more of this material, everything from lectures and classes to interviews on the media and much else, are available at our two websites, which I would like to welcome you to make use of 24/7 at no charge. The first one is rdwolff.com, and the second one is Democracy at Work, that's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Not only can you get all this material there, but it's each of these websites has a way for you to communicate to us your questions, comments, criticisms, what you like and don't like about the program, all of which we read and make use of. And likewise, if you go to either of these two websites, you can click on the icons for Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest and follow us on an ongoing way in that manner, and we invite you to do so. Our next major topic that we want to spend some time on is something called privatization. What does it mean? Very simple. Privatization is the word we use to describe a situation where a public authority, a city government, a state government, a national government, chooses to sell its own property, the property of the state, which is, in other words, the property of the people as a whole, because the state acts as the representative of everyone, state property, for example, land, forests, mountains, the state owns that in the name of and as the custodian for the property of the community as a whole. Other kinds of state property you're familiar with. In many countries, the government operates the transportation system, the subways, the trains, and the bus systems. So those are public property. In many countries, the water system is owned and operated by the state to make sure that we all have access to clean, safe water, and so on. Post offices are often run by the government, and so forth and so on. Privatization is when the government sells this property to a particular owner, a private person or a private company. Could be domestic, could be foreign. The government sells. So let's talk about that. There are two major forces that push for privatization. The first one is the fiscal crisis we've been in for the last 6 years. Some countries have been in worse crises earlier, at other times, for other periods of time. Whenever a crisis hits, one of the first things that happens is that people lose their jobs. One of the qualities of the capitalist economic system is what's called the business cycle, this constantly recurring situation where suddenly masses of people are thrown out of work, production is reduced, and we go through months or years of an economic crisis no one seems to want, no one seems to have expected, and that everyone wants to see over, even though it lasts months or years. To say the very least, a bit strange to have an economic system that works in this way. But that's another conversation. When this happened, when millions of people lose their jobs, they therefore stop earning income and they pay less in the way of income taxes. Corporations that reduce production because they fire all these people likewise pay less in taxes. So suddenly the government has less revenue to do what it's supposed to do. Yet at the same time, the demands for government services go up precisely because there's an economic crisis. People need more. An unemployed person needs unemployment insurance. He or she didn't need it when they had their job. So when the economy tanks and they lose their job, they suddenly need to ask and get help. Unemployment insurance. We know for a fact that when you have high unemployment, medical needs of people go up. Children have a harder time in school because they're upset by their parents' difficulties. So they need, in other words, make a long story short, the government service provision is expected to do more because people out of work have greater needs. So we have a crazy moment. The government gets less in the way of tax revenue because all these people are unemployed, but more is demanded of the government, and it's torn between these two contradictory demands. Another example, I might say parenthetically, of the contradictions that beset capitalism as an economic system. But my point in telling you this is that governments squeezed in this way sometimes desperately resort to privatization. That is, they look around for something valuable that the city or the state or the national government has that they might find a way to sell to someone in the private sector. Why do politicians do that? Because in a crisis, it's very unpopular for them to tax people, many of whom are having difficulty, and the last thing they want is to pay more taxes. Companies, many of whom are having difficulty, and the last thing they want to do is pay more taxes. So the politician is afraid of going after them. And at the same time, the politician doesn't want to respond to the greater needs people have by cutting back. Sure, there are some politicians who will invent stories about why this is virtuous to do, but they're all afraid of it. So one easy solution for them is to get the money they need to keep the services flowing, but without taxing folks. And one of the ways of doing that is privatization, selling off what the government has. So, for example, around the world, many local governments are selling pieces of land within their jurisdiction that they perhaps used for storage, that they perhaps used as a public park. Oh, yes, that's happening everywhere. A part of the park is shaved off. A part of the park is made available to a restaurant that wants to use it. Somehow public property is sold. In more drastic cases, whole water companies run by a state are sold off to a private company. The state gets a one-time lump sum of money that can ease the life of those politicians who do it, and so they do it. And so we have privatization. In the long run, is that wise or not? Well, that brings us to the second argument for privatization. Private companies, eager to buy public property, for example, a company eager to get its hands on the water system of a city, want that city to sell it, the water system, or a company that wants to control the bus system, or a company that wants to make a high-rise building where there once was a public school, they've got all the arguments that work like this. It's better for something to be privately owned and operated than for the city, state, or national government. Private enterprise, we are told, is more efficient. Private enterprise is more effective than leaving it in the hands of public. We are told to believe that public authorities are somehow, by their very nature, inefficient or at least less efficient than the private. There's literally no evidence for this at all. For every example of a situation where public went private and we got an improvement in the situation, we have an example where we got the opposite. And likewise, when we took things away from the private and gave it to the public, there are as many examples of that being an improvement as there are examples of that being a problem. So at the very least, from the estimates and the evidence we have, it's an open question in terms of the public which way is quote-unquote better in terms of the cost of the service or the quality. So the answer is, we don't sell property to gain efficiency. We sell property because the people who want it push for it, and the politicians who need it cave in. I'm putting aside the questions of when corruption enters the story, but that's not an unimportant matter at all. So now let's look at the economics. Why is this the case? Well, one of the ways that private companies offer, as they often do, to perform some public service, collect the garbage, provide the water, even teach the schools, one of the ways they claim to be able to do this at lower cost is because they pay lower wages. That's right. The cities are subject to the pressure of the public, and they can't go around paying people next to nothing. There's too much public awareness of it. There's too much of a sense of the public that the government is responsible to them and they don't want the government to be paying wages at a poverty level. But in the private sector, things are a lot easier in that direction. So, for example, in the public sector of the United States, 30% of the workers, roughly, are in a union. In the private sector, less than 7%. So private employers can get away with things that public employers simply can't. So one of the major ways that private employers make the argument, make the case that they can do some function more cheaply than a public is because they pay people less. They provide fewer benefits, they provide less of the packages to help people, and they pay less. And so in turn, they can charge less. Is that sometimes true? Yes, it is. But if we take advantage of that in our societies, if we take advantage, we take some function away from the public sector, we give it to the private sector, which can do it more cheaply because it pays workers much less and provides them with fewer benefits, let's be clear what we're doing. We're not just getting cheaper services because a company does that. That's kind of the good news, if you like. But we're getting some bad news, too, which you better bet is going to affect your life. The bad news is more and more of our neighbors and our friends and our fellow citizens and our family members are going to have much poorer in the way of jobs. Their jobs are going to pay less, have fewer benefits. That's what this means. And those people are going to need government help more than they used to. And they're going to end up being a social problem also for all of us. So beware what it means to privatize. Second, when you take something from a private enterprise and you make it a government enterprise, for example, you say that private sector can't control the water. The public has to do that. One of the reasons the public often does the job more cheaply than the private, and let me assure you, that happens just as much, at least as much, as the other way around. One of the reasons is very simple economics. Public enterprises, public institutions that produce goods and services. They have to pay workers, sure they do, and they have to buy equipment and machinery, just like everybody else. But there's something they don't have to do that all private enterprises do have to do, and therein lies a reason why public production can often be cheaper. Simple. The public enterprise doesn't have to make a profit. It doesn't have any shareholders to send dividends to. It doesn't have any stock market looking down at them to see how profitable they are. They're not supposed to make a profit. The public is supposed to provide, the public enterprise is supposed to provide us with what we want, pay the costs of producing it, but not to earn a profit. Every private enterprise has to pay a profit, otherwise no one's going to go in to a private enterprise if it doesn't make a profit, since that's the purpose. So the advantage of the public, no, pay no profit. The advantage of the private, pay lower wages. You think about these two options and ask yourself whether the privatization push that has been everywhere in the last 10 years is about helping all of us or about helping the usual subset, the small minority who own and operate the bulk of private enterprise. Well, folks, we've come to the part of our program where we deal with your questions, questions that you've sent in, and I want to deal with several of them that I thought were very interesting came in over the last couple of weeks. The first one clearly is a knowledgeable person, probably a person from the United Kingdom, because it's about London and England more generally. And the question is the following. Money has been pumped into the English economy by the Bank of England at an enormous clip. And I might say parenthetically that the same is true of the United States and of many other countries. One of the ways of dealing with this economic crisis in most countries has been printing, creating both physical and electronic masses of money and pouring them into the economy in the hope of getting out of this crisis. It hasn't worked real well. And the reason it hasn't, one reason it hasn't worked real well is that that money, pumping that money in, was supposed to lead people to buy more goods and services, which would put people back to work in the jobs they had before the crisis hit. That was the idea. Didn't work out. Why? Because the big producers look at the Western economies, North America, Western Europe, Japan, as economies that are in long periods of slow growth, decline. The growing areas are in Asia, Latin America, and elsewhere. And so they're not eager to produce more in North America, Western Europe, and Japan. And they're not interested in taking that money that the government is flooding in there and using it to produce. So what do they do with the money? Well, the answer is they either hold on to it, trillions are being held by these corporations, or they speculate. This happens often. They buy real estate, they buy stocks and bonds. One of the reasons stock markets have gone up is that flood of money has found its way into stocks. The people with money buy a stock, knowing that there are other people who are going to take their money and buy that stock. The stock price is going to go up, and they can make more money buying and flipping stocks than producing for an uncertain market, since the mass of people don't have enough to buy what they're capable of producing. End result. Bubbles in real estate. Vast sums of money pouring in quickly to buy homes, houses, condos, co-ops, whatever. And the price of housing goes up. So in England, to answer the question, we have a housing bubble well underway. Prices, for example, in London over the last year, up 17%. In the rest of England, up almost 10%. More and more banks are seeing that they have to participate. Why? Because one bank gets into lending and these folks buy a property and flip it 2 weeks later or 3 months later or a year later. The price has gone up. They've made a good bundle. Who do they sell it to? Another person who's borrowed money from the banks, who are flush with the government's additional money, and they all have to get in on it because any bank that holds back is not going to show the kind of profit that the bank that gets into this game
can show. So the competition among the banks makes them all into speculators. A little bit like I said earlier, the competition among companies makes them all spend ridiculously on advertising in a way that is socially and economically irrational. Well, we have irrationality in the housing market. The bubbles go up, everybody's buying an apartment, flipping an apartment, selling it for more, until, of course, the day comes, as it inevitably does, when someone, the last one who bought the house at a wild price, discovers that things have gotten so high and banks have lent so much money to people who are really taking a risk that you can't sell that house, which means you can't repay the bank from whom you borrowed the money to get that house. And then suddenly the house of cards collapses. The run-up in prices produces a collapse of real estate. We've had that in the last 20 years in Tokyo, in New York, in London. I mean, it is now a boringly repeated situation. So serious is it in London, though, that the new chair of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, right now is struggling with what to do, how to control and prevent another explosive bubble that will burst, fearful that if he lets that happen, the bursting of the real estate bubble will collapse the banks, who are already in shaky conditions because of the ongoing crisis since 2007. You put all this together, he's terrified if he does too much, if he doesn't do something, the bubble will burst and the recovery in England will collapse. But if he does something, like raise interest rates to slow down the borrowing, that will also undermine the so-called recovery in England. Either way, he's trapped. The system not only produces a recession, this is the system that responds with flooding the economy with money. This is the system that responds to a flood of money by a real estate bubble. And this is the system which now has to respond to that bubble by taking a step that risks the end of the recovery and plunging back. Once again, we see the contradictions of this system threaten everybody. And therefore, sooner or later, friends, must raise the question in a thoughtful person, why are we staying with a system that works this way, that produces these contradictions, that confronts us with these palpable dangers we have now gone through over and over again? Another one of you asked me to talk a little bit about how worker co-ops would work in a manner that is different from the way a private corporation works. And that's a very important topic, and I want to address that in the time that we have that remains in our program today. So here we go. The basic reality of our economic system is that we produce goods and services that earn a so-called profit. Workers produce more when they work than they are paid for doing so. And in that difference, in what workers produce that is greater in value than what they get paid, lies the profit. The surplus, that extra that workers produce that they don't get, that becomes the profit of an industry. If workers were running the industry themselves, they would still be producing more than they get, but it would be they who get that difference. It would be they who literally decide, hey, we're going to produce more, we're going to make more goods and services worth more than we pay ourselves as individual workers, our salaries. And that difference is the surplus of our business. It's the profits we make. The difference is, instead of giving those to other people, the capitalists who started the business, we keep it. We get together and decide what to do with that surplus, which is just the difference between giving the money to a board of directors and major shareholders and having them decide. It democratizes the enterprise. But it still leaves the workers collectively with expenses they have to take care of. Just like a board of directors or the capitalists use wealth the profits they get, to take care of their expenses. This is an important distinction. We're not saying that in a worker collective there are no profits or there's no surplus or the workers give everything to themselves. That would be silly. The workers know they have to, for example, put aside a part of the surplus for an eventuality, unexpected rainy day problem. They know they have to use some of it to improve their technology so they stay competitive. They know all these things, just like capitalists know it. The difference between the two kinds of systems, this is important for the question some of you asked, the difference for the two kinds of systems lies precisely in who makes the decisions. Is it a separate group of boards of directors and major shareholders, or a tiny group, or is it a democratically collective decision made by the workers in an enterprise? If, for example, the corporation, the enterprise, needs people to work on sales, they don't produce anything, they sell it. Or they need people to be accountants, or they need people to keep track of records of things, clerks, they will then have to take a part of the surplus they produced and use it to pay those people to do that. Just like a private capitalist enterprise does that. The workers understand that. They're using the surplus to secure these other activities necessary for the enterprise to function. But it's the workers who think that through. It's the workers who decide how to do that. So, for example, if workers did it and they listened to this program, they might decide that it would be important not to advertise, to maybe get a law passed that says no more advertising, that we have certain agencies that compare the qualities and strengths of different products and they report to the public and that's it, that we don't have private advertising because it's a waste of resources, because it has bad social effect, and so on. We might expect a worker's co-op-based economy to go in such a direction. Clearly, private capitalist economies have never even entertained the idea, let alone gone in that direction, and so we had the criticism I made earlier in this program. So the difference between a workers' co-op and a private enterprise is particularly about who makes the decisions, and because that's so different in the two, you can begin to see how the outcomes, the decisions actually made, will be very different as well. I want to thank you all for your attention. We've come to the end of another economic update. I hope you found the topics and the treatments interesting, and I hope that you will join us again next week.